her chance to see inside the house. No, it was impossible. Elodie decided that she would risk Penelope's displeasure and cancel the appointment first thing. She fell asleep at last to the noise of the nearby river and dreamed of Leonard and Juliet, Edward and Lily Millington, and at one stage even the mysterious Jack, whose purpose at the house was still in question. Who had intuited her need to see inside, who had been kind about her mother's death, and to whom, though she would never admit it when awake, she found herself inexplicably drawn. Chapter 23. There had been a change in the wind over the last half hour. It was still not midday, but the sky was darkening, and Jack had a feeling it was going to rain later. He was standing on the edge of the meadow and picked up his camera, looking through the viewfinder at the distant water's edge. It was a powerful zoom, and he was able to zero in on the tops of some reeds that grew along the bank. He sharpened the focus, and in his concentration the noise of the river disappeared. Jack didn't take the photo. The temporary silence was enough. He had known there was a river. In the brief that he'd been given, there'd been a map of the property. But he hadn't realised he would hear it at night when he closed his eyes to go to sleep. The river was placid up here. Jack had been talking to a fellow with a narrowboat who told him there was a strong pull after storms. He'd gone along with the story, but he didn't really believe it. There were too many locks and weirs that ran the length of the Thames for it to flow with wildness. The river might have been violent once upon a time, but it had long since been shackled and tamed. Jack knew a bit about water. There had been a creek across the road from their house when he was growing up. It had run dry much of the time, and then when the rains finally came, it would fill in a matter of hours. It would rush and tumble, angry and hungry, roaring day and night. He and his brother Ben used to take an inflatable raft out to ride the short-lived rapids, knowing full well that in a matter of days the creek would be returned to its usual stagnant dribble. Their dad had always warned them about the raft and about kids who went into drain pipes when the floods came. But Ben and Jack only rolled their eyes at each other and made sure to blow up the raft after they'd sneaked it out of the garage and across the road. They weren't worried about the creek. They knew how to handle themselves in water. Until they didn't, that is. Until the flood that happened in the summer, when Ben was 11 and Jack was 9. In the distance, the sky lit up golden, and a low disgruntlement of thunder rolled softly down the river towards him. Jack checked his watch and saw that it was almost midday. The atmosphere was eerie, that strange, unearthly twilight that always settled before a storm. He turned around and started back towards the house. The carpenter had left a light on, he noticed, as he crossed the meadow. He could see it up in the attic window, and Jack reminded himself to turn it off when he opened the house for Elodie. She was waiting for him when he reached the coachway, and the iron gate came into sight. She lifted her hand to wave, and then she smiled, and Jack felt the same frisson of interest that he'd felt the evening before. He blamed it on the house. He'd been sleeping poorly, and not just because of the god-awful mattress on the bed in the malt house. He'd been having weird dreams ever since he arrived, and although it wasn't the sort of thing he'd have brought up in the local pub, there was a strange feeling in the house, as if he were being watched. "You are, you fool," he told himself, "by the mice." But it didn't feel like mice. The sense of being watched reminded Jack of the early days of being in love, when the most ordinary of glances was loaded with meaning. When half a smile from a particular woman could cause a stirring deep down low within his belly. He gave himself a stern word about overcomplicating his life. He was here to convince Sarah that he should be given another chance to know their girls. That was it. And possibly to find a lost diamond, if it existed, which it most likely didn't. She had a suitcase with her, Jack saw as he got closer. "Moving in," he called. A blush came immediately to her cheeks. He liked the way she blushed. "I'm on my way back to London."
"Where did you park?"
"I'm going by train. I'm due at the station in about 4 hours.
"You'll be wanting to see inside then."
He cocked his head towards the gate.
"Come on in. I'll open up the house." Jack was supposed to be packing to leave, but after letting Elodie into the house, he decided to work through Rosalind Wheeler's paperwork one last time, just in case he found something he'd previously missed. Rosalind Wheeler was not a particularly pleasant person, and the search seemed hopeless, but she'd hired him to do a job, and Jack didn't like letting people down. It was one of the things that Sarah used to say to him towards the end. "You have to stop trying to be everybody's hero, Jack. It's not going to bring Ben back." He'd hated it when she said that sort of thing. But he saw now that she'd been right. His entire career, his entire adult life, he'd spent chasing something he could do that would erase the photos that had turned up in all the papers after the flood. The big one of Jack, his eyes wide and frightened, a heated blanket around his shoulders being loaded into a waiting ambulance, and the smaller school photo of Ben that Dad had insisted on having taken earlier that year, Ben's hair combed carefully from one side, neater than it ever looked in real life. Their roles had been assigned by those newspaper articles and set as hard as a concrete slab. Jack, the boy who was saved, and Ben, the boy hero who'd said to his rescuer, "Take my little brother first," before being washed away. Jack glanced back towards the door. It had been half an hour since he'd let Elodie into the house, and he was distracted. She'd stood to one side as he switched off the alarm and loosened the lock, and when he pushed the door open, she'd thanked him and been about to step across the threshold when she hesitated and said, "You don't work for the museum, do you?"
"No."
"Are you a student?"
"I'm a detective."
"With the police?"
"Used to be, not anymore."
He hadn't offered anything further. It didn't seem necessary to volunteer that the change of vocation was in response to a marriage breakdown. And she hadn't asked. After a moment of silence, she'd nodded thoughtfully and then disappeared inside Birchwood Manor. The whole time that she had been in there, Jack had been fighting an almost irresistible urge to follow her. No matter how many times he returned to the first page of the notes, he found his thoughts wandering, speculating as to what she was doing, where she was right at that minute, which room she was exploring. At one point, he'd even stood up and gone to the door of the house before he realised what he was doing. Jack decided to make a cup of tea, just to have a task to see through to its end, and was dunking the tea bag violently when he sensed her behind him. He guessed she was about to say goodbye, and so before she could, he said,
"Copper, I've just boiled the kettle."
"Why not?" She sounded surprised, whether by the invitation or her acceptance of it, he couldn't tell. "A little bit of milk, please, and no sugar." Jack took out a second mug, careful to find a nice one that didn't have tannin stains around the base. When the two mugs of tea were ready, he carried them over to where she was standing now, on the stone-paved path that ran around the house. She thanked him and said, "There's not much that smells better than a storm brewing." Jack agreed and they sat together on the edge of the path. "So," she said, after she'd taken a first sip, "what's a detective doing picking locks at a museum?"
"I was hired by someone to look for something."
"Like a treasure hunter, with a map and everything. X marks the spot."
"Something like that, but without the X. That's what's making it all a bit tedious."
"And what is it you're looking for?" He hesitated, thinking of the non-disclosure contract Rosalind Wheeler had made him sign. Jack didn't mind breaking rules, but he didn't like breaking promises. He did like Elodie, though, and he had the strongest sense that he should tell her.
"You realise," he said, "that the woman who hired me could kill me for telling you."
"I'm intrigued."
"And yet not worried for my life, I see."
"What if I promise not to tell a soul? I never break a promise." Forget Rosalind Wheeler. The urge was going to kill him first.
"I'm looking for a stone. A blue diamond."
Her eyes widened. "Not the Radcliffe blue."
"The what?"
She opened her backpack and pulled out an old book with yellowing pages. Edward Radcliffe, His Life and Loves. Jack read the cover aloud.
"I've seen his name in the churchyard."
This used to be his house, and the Radcliffe Blue, as the name suggests, belonged to his family.
I've never heard it called that. My client said the diamond belonged to her grandmother, a woman called Ada Lovegrove.
Elodie shook her head, the name evidently unfamiliar. Edward Radcliffe took the blue from his family's safe in 1862 so his model, Lily Millington, could wear it in a painting. The story goes that she stole it and ran away to America, breaking Radcliffe's heart in the process. Elodie turned carefully through the pages until she reached a colour plate near the centre. She pointed to a painting called La Belle and said, "That's her. That's Lily Millington, Edward Radcliffe's model, and the woman he loved." Looking at the painting, Jack felt an enormous pull of familiarity, and then he realised that, of course, he'd seen the painting many times before, for it was printed on at least half of the bags that he'd seen tourists carrying with them when they left the museum gift shop on Saturdays. Elodie handed him another photograph, taken reverently from her bag. This was the same subject as in the painting, but here, perhaps because it was a photograph, she looked like a woman instead of a goddess. She was beautiful, but beyond that, there was something attractive in the directness with which she stared at the photographer. Jack felt a strange stirring, almost as if he were looking at a picture of someone he knew, someone he cared for deeply.
"Where did you get this?"
The urgency of his tone had clearly surprised her, and a slight frown of interest tugged at her eyebrows. "At work, it was in a picture frame that belonged to James Stratton, the man whose archives I keep." James Stratton was no one to Jack, and yet the question had formed and was out of his mouth before he even knew that he was going to ask it.
"Tell me about him. What did he do? How did he come to have archives worth keeping?"
She considered a moment. "No one ever asks me about James Stratton."
"I'm interested."
And he was, although he couldn't have said quite why, keenly interested. She remained quizzical but pleased. "He was a businessman, very successful. He came from a family of huge wealth and importance, but he was also a social reformer."
"How do you mean?"
"He fronted a number of those Victorian committees aimed at improving the lives of the poor, and he actually managed to make a difference. He was well connected, articulate, patient and determined. He was kind and giving. He was instrumental in getting the poor laws repealed, providing housing and protecting abandoned children. He worked at every level, lobbying members of parliament, rallying wealthy businessmen to make donations, even working on the streets, handing out food to those who couldn't afford it. He dedicated his life to helping others."
"He sounds heroic."
"He was." Jack felt the pinch of another question.
"What would make someone from a life of privilege take up the cause in such a dedicated way?"
"He formed an unlikely friendship in his childhood with a little girl who lived in unsavoury circumstances."
"How did that happen?"
"For a long time, no one knew. He doesn't mention any of the details in his diaries. We only knew that there was a friendship at all because of a couple of speeches he gave in later life where he alluded to the relationship."
"And now?"
Elodie was clearly excited by whatever she was going to tell him next, and Jack couldn't help notice how her eyes brightened when she smiled. "I found something the other day. You're the first person I've told. I didn't know what it was initially, but as I read it, I realised." She reached again into her backpack and slid a clear plastic file out of a folder. Inside was a letter written on fine paper, clearly old, creases revealing that it had spent much of its time folded and pressed. Jack began to read. "My dearest one and only Jay, what I have to tell you now is my deepest secret. I am going away for a time to America, and I do not know how long I will be gone. I have told no one else, for reasons that will be evident to you, but I approach the journey with great excitement and hope. I cannot say more now, but you are not to worry. I will write again when it is safe to do so. Oh, but I will miss you, my dearest friend. How grateful I am for the day that I climbed through your window, the policeman on my tail, and you gave me the thaumatrope. Which of us could have imagined then what lay ahead? My dearest Joe, I have enclosed a photograph, something for you to remember me by. I will miss you more than anything I can imagine missing. And as you know, I would not say such a thing lightly. Until we meet again, then I remain your most grateful and ever-loving B.B.
He looked up. She called him Joe, not James.
A lot of people did. He never used his real name, except for official purposes.
And what about the B.B.? What does that stand for?
Elodie shook her head. That I don't know. But whatever it stands for, I think the woman who wrote that letter, James Stratton's childhood friend, grew up to be the woman in that photograph, Edward Radcliffe's model.
What makes you so sure?
For one thing, I found the letter sealed within the back of the frame that held the photo. For another, Leonard Gilbert revealed that Lily Millington wasn't the model's real name. And for a third...
I like this theory. It's tight.
I had this other problem. I discovered recently that Edward Radcliffe came to see James Stratton in 1867. Not only that, he left his precious satchel and sketchbook in Stratton's care for safekeeping. The two men weren't connected in any way that I knew of, and at the time, I had no idea what the tie between them could be.
But now you think it's her.
I know it's her. I've never been so certain of anything. I feel it. Do you know?
Jack nodded. He did know.
Whoever she is, she's the key.
Jack was looking at the photograph. I don't reckon she did it. Steal the diamond, I mean. In fact, I'm sure of it.
Based on what? The photo? Jack wondered how to explain the sudden certainty that had overcome him as he stared at the photograph, the woman meeting his gaze. He was almost sick with it. Thankfully, he was spared having to answer as Elodie continued. I don't think she did either, and neither did Leonard Gilbert, as it turns out. I had a feeling when I was reading his book that his heart wasn't in it, and then I found a second article that he'd published in 1938, where he said that he'd asked his source outright whether she believed that Lily Millington had participated in the robbery, and she told him she knew for a fact that she hadn't.
So it's possible that the diamond really is still here, like my client's grandmother told her.
Well, anything's possible, I guess, although it's been a very long time. What exactly did she tell you?
She said that her grandmother had lost something precious, and there was good reason to believe that it was on an estate in England.
Her grandmother told her this?
In a manner of speaking. She suffered a stroke, and when she started to recover, her words came back to her all in a rush, and she started talking about her life, her childhood, her past, with a great sense of urgency. She spoke about a diamond that was precious to her, that she'd left at the house where she went to school. It was all a bit piecemeal, I gather. But after her grandmother died, my client came across a number of items in her effects that she's convinced were her grandmother's way of telling her where to look for it.
Why hadn't the grandmother come to retrieve the diamond herself? It sounds a bit dubious to me.
Jack agreed. And I haven't turned up any treasure yet. Her grandmother definitely had a connection to this place, though. When she died, she left a significant legacy to the group who run the museum. It enabled them to set it up. That's why my client was able to organise permission for me to stay here.
What did she tell them?
That I'm a photojournalist, here for a fortnight, working on an assignment.
So she doesn't mind bending the truth. Jack smiled, thinking back to Rosalind Wheeler's Terrier Manor.
I have no doubt that she believes every word of what she told me. And to be fair, there was one piece of evidence that seemed to support the theory.
He reached into his pocket and produced his copy of the letter Rosalind Wheeler had emailed the other day.
It's from Lucy Redcliffe. He must have been...
Edward's sister.
Right. Written to my client's grandmother in 1939.
Elodie skimmed it and then read a paragraph out loud. I was most disturbed by your letter. I don't care what you saw in the newspaper or how it made you feel. I insist that you don't do as you say. Come and visit me, by all means, but you're not to bring it with you. I don't want it. I never want to see it again.
It caused great upset for my family and for me. It is yours, it came to you, remember, against all odds, and I wanted you to have it. Think of it as a gift, if you must. She looked up. This doesn't actually mention a diamond.
No.
They could have been talking about anything. He agreed. Do you know what she saw in the paper?
Something to do with the blue, perhaps.
Perhaps, and we could probably find out. But for now, we're only guessing. Did you mean it when you said you had a map? Jack, noting and liking her use of the word we, told her that he'd be back in a minute and went to fetch the map from the end of his bed inside the malt house. He brought it out to the path and handed it to her.
My client put this together, based on Ada Lovegrove's effects and the things she said after her stroke.
Elodie opened it out and frowned with concentration. Moments later, she smiled and gave a soft laugh.
Oh, Jack, she said. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, but this isn't a treasure map. It's the map from a children's story.
Which story?
Remember the one I mentioned to you yesterday? The story that my great-uncle heard when he was here as a boy in the war, that he told to my mum, who then told it to me?
Yes?
The places on this map, the clearing in the woods, this fairy mound, the Crofters River Bend, they're all from the story. Elodie smiled gently and handed the folded map back to him. Your client's grandmother had a stroke. Maybe it was all just a case of her childhood rushing back upon her. She lifted her shoulders apologetically. I'm afraid I don't have anything more helpful to offer. It is fascinating, though, to think that your client's grandmother knows my family's story.
Somehow, I don't think my client's going to be as happy with the coincidence as she was hoping to be when I brought her back a diamond.
Sorry about that.
Not your fault. I'm sure you didn't mean to shatter an old lady's dreams.
She smiled. On that note, and she started reloading her backpack.
You've still got a couple of hours before your train leaves.
Yes, but I should get going. I've already taken up enough of your time. You're busy.
You're right. After I master this map, I thought I'd look for the doorway to Narnia in the back of the wardrobe upstairs.
She laughed, and Jack felt it like a personal victory.
You know, he said, pushing his luck, I was thinking about you last night.
She blushed again. Really?
Do you still have that photograph on you? The one of your mum from yesterday?
Elodie was suddenly serious. Do you think you might know where it was taken?
It's worth another look. I've spent a fair bit of time combing through the garden on my hunt for the door to fairyland, you know.
She passed him the photograph, and one side of her mouth tightened slightly. An endearing sign that despite all odds, she still hoped that he may actually be able to help her. And Jack wanted to be able to help her. You have to stop trying to be everybody's hero, Jack. He had been stalling when he asked to see the photo. He'd hoped to stop her from leaving so soon, but as he looked at it, as he took in the ivy and the hint of a structure and the way the light fell, the answer came to him as clearly as if he'd just been told. Jack, she said, what is it? He smiled and gave the photo back.
Up for a little walk.
Elodie walked beside him through the churchyard and stopped when they reached the far corner. He glanced at her, gave a little smile of encouragement, and then wandered away slowly, pretending interest in the other graves. She let out a held breath, for he had been right. It was the scene from the photograph. Elodie could tell at once that this was where the picture had been taken. It had changed very little, despite 25 years having passed. Elodie had expected to feel sad, even a little bit resentful. But she didn't. This was a beautiful, peaceful place, and she was glad to think that a young woman whose life was cut suddenly short had spent her last hours in it. For the first time ever, as she stood in the grove of ivy surrounded by the hum of cemetery stillness, Elodie saw clearly that she and her mother were two different women, that she did not have to remain the smaller handprint within the larger one forever.
Lauren had been talented and beautiful and a tremendous success. But it occurred to Elodie that the biggest difference between them was none of those things. It was their approach to life. Where Lauren had lived fearlessly, Elodie always guarded against failure. It struck her now that maybe she needed to let go a bit more often. To try and, yes, occasionally to fail. To accept that life is messy and sometimes mistakes are made. That sometimes they're not even really mistakes. Because life isn't linear, and it comprises countless small and large decisions every day. Which wasn't to say that loyalty wasn't important, because Elodie believed strenuously that it was. Only, maybe, just maybe, things weren't as black and white as she had always believed. As her father and Tip kept trying to tell her, life was long. Being a human wasn't easy. And who was she to judge anyway? Elodie had spent most of yesterday at a wedding reception venue, nodding politely while well-intentioned women bamboozled her with talk of various types of bonbonnière, and why she didn't want to go that way. As all the while she'd been longing to get back to Birchwood Manor and to an Australian man who seemed to think she would believe he was employed by the museum. She had wondered yesterday when she first showed him Caroline's photograph, why she was oversharing in such an uncharacteristic way. She had convinced herself that it was simply a result of her weariness and the emotion of the day. It had seemed a reasonable theory, and she had almost believed it until today, when she came around the corner from the meadow.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, peering now at her side. "I'm more okay than I thought I would be." He smiled.
"Then, judging by that sky, I reckon we probably ought to think about getting out of here."
The first rain, big, fat, drenching drops, fell as they were leaving the churchyard, and Jack said,
"I never imagined that it would rain like this in England."
"Are you kidding? Rain is what we do best." He laughed, and she felt a jolt of something very pleasant. His arms were wet, and she was overcome with an irresistible urge, a need to reach out and touch his bare skin. Without a word, and although it made no sense, she took his hand, and together they started running back towards the house. 9. It is raining and they have come inside. Not a light shower, but the beginning of a storm. I have been watching it build out there all afternoon, beyond the head of the river, over the distant mountains. There have been many storms in my time at Birchwood. I have become used to the changed, charged atmosphere as air is drawn towards the front. But this storm feels different. It feels like something is going to happen. I am restless and infused with anticipation. My thoughts skip from here to there, picking through the stream of recent conversation, turning over this stone and then that one. I have been thinking about Lucy, who suffered so terribly after Edward's death. It gladdens me to learn that she told Leonard at last that I was not a faithless lover. I care little for the opinions of those I did not know, but Leonard mattered to me, and I am relieved he knew the truth. I have been thinking of Pale Joe, too. For so long I craved to know what became of him. How pleased I am, how proud, to hear of what he achieved, that he took his kindness and influence and his steely sense of justice and put them to work. But oh, how cruel it is to have fallen from his life when I did. And I have been thinking of Edward, as always. And that stormy night spent here, in this house, so many years ago. I miss Edward most on stormy nights. It was his idea that we should come here for the summer, to his house, his beloved twin-gabled house on the river, before travelling on to America. He told me his plan on the evening of his 22nd birthday, as candlelight danced across the night-darkened walls of his studio. "I have something for you," he said, to which I laughed because it was his birthday and not mine. Yours is next month, he said, waving away my half-hearted protest. That's near enough. Besides, we do not need reasons to surprise one another, you and I.
I insisted nonetheless that I should be allowed to give him my gift first, and held my breath as he began to unwrap the brown paper. For a decade I had been doing just as Lily Millington advised, keeping a small portion of my spoils each week in a hidden place. At first I did not know what I was saving for, only that Lily had told me to do it, and in truth it did not matter, for there is a security to be gained from saving that transcends purpose. As I got older, though, and my father's letters continued to counsel patience, I made myself a promise. If he did not send for me by my 18th birthday, I would buy myself a ticket to America and travel there alone to find him. I would be 18 in June 1862 and had saved almost enough for a single ticket. But since I'd met Edward, my thoughts for the future had shifted. When I saw Pale Joe in April, I asked him where one should go to procure a leather gift of the highest quality. And he sent me to his father's supplier, Mr. Sims, on Bond Street. It was there in that shop, which smelled of spice and mystery, that I placed my order. Edward's face when he unwrapped the satchel was worth every ill-gotten, squirreled-away secret penny. He ran his fingertips over the leather, taking in the fine stitching, the embossed initials, and then he opened it and slipped his sketchbook inside. It fitted, as I had hoped it would, like a hand into a glove. Immediately he put the strap over his shoulder, and from that day until the last, I did not see him without the satchel that Mr. Sims had made to my instructions. He moved closer then to where I was standing by the bench of art supplies, his proximity causing my breath to catch, and from the pocket of his coat he took an envelope. "And now," he said softly, "the first half of my gift to you." How well he knew me. How well he loved me. For within the envelope lay two tickets on a ship making the Atlantic crossing in August. "But Edward," I said, "the cost."
He shook his head.
"Sleeping Beauty was beloved. The exhibition was a great success, and it is all down to you."
"I did little."
"No," he said, suddenly serious. "I could not paint without you now. I won't."
The tickets were made out in the name of Mr. and Mrs. Radcliffe.
"You'll never have to," I promised.
"And when we're in America, we will find your father."
My mind was racing, planning ahead, picking a pattern through the bright new possibilities, considering the best way to extricate myself from Mrs. Mack and the captain, to avoid letting Martin know until the last, when it came to an abrupt stop.
"But Edward," I said, "what about Fanny?"
A slight frown line appeared between his eyes.
"I will let her down gently. She will be all right. She is young and pretty and wealthy. She will have other suitors begging for the chance to marry her. She will understand in time. It is another good reason for us to go to America. The kindest thing for Fanny. It will allow distance for the dust to settle, for her to spin whatever story she prefers."
Edward never said a word that he did not believe with all his heart. And of this, too, I know he was convinced. He took my hand in his and kissed it, and when he smiled at me, such was his power of persuasion, I believed that what he said was true.
"And now," he said, his smile widening as he took from the bench a large parcel, "the second half of your gift."
With his free hand, he led me to the cushions on the floor and placed the present, surprisingly heavy, upon my lap. He watched keenly, almost jittery with anticipation, as I started to unwrap it. When I reached the last layer of paper, there, within the shroud, was the most beautiful wall clock that I had ever seen.
The box casing and face were both made of finely crafted wood, with Roman numerals inlaid in gold, and delicate hands with tapered arrows. I brushed the palm of my hand across the smooth surface, the luster cast by a nearby candle picking out the grain of the wood. I was overwhelmed by the gift. Living with Mrs. Mack, I had not acquired a single possession of my own, let alone an object of such beauty. But the clock was precious beyond its material value. Its bestowal was Edward's way of demonstrating that he knew me, that he understood who I really was.
"Do you like it?" he said.
"I love it."
"And I love you."
He kissed me, but as he withdrew, his brows shifted.
"What is it? You look as if you've just been handed trouble."
And that is precisely how I felt. Almost as soon as I had received the clock, my thrill was replaced by a great covetous need to protect the precious gift. There was no way I could take it near the Seven Dials without Mrs. Mack putting a price upon it. "I think that I should hang it here," I said.
"I have another idea. In fact, there is something important that I must talk to you about."
Edward had mentioned the house by the river before, and I had observed the way his expression changed, a look of longing coming upon his face, which would have made me envious had we been speaking of another woman. But as he told me now of his need that I should see his house, there was something else underlying his features, a vulnerability that made me want to take him in my arms and soothe whatever distant trial such talk evoked.
"I have an idea for my next painting," he said at last.
"Tell me." And that is when he relayed to me what had happened to him when he was 14 years old, the night in the woods, the light in the window, his certainty that he had been saved by the house. When I asked him how a house could save a boy, he told me the ancient folktale of the Eldritch children that he had learned from his grandfather's gardener, about the queen of the fairies who left the land on the bend of the river blessed and any house that stood upon it lit.
"Your house," I whispered. "And yours now, too, where we shall hang your clock, so that it can keep count of the days, the weeks, the months, until we return. In fact," he smiled, "I thought we would invite everyone to Birchwood for the summer, before we leave for America. It will be a way of saying goodbye, although they will not know it. What do you say?"
What could I say but yes? There was a knock at the door then, and Edward called out,
"Yes?"
It was his little sister Lucy, whose glance swept the room in an instant, taking in Edward and me, the new satchel on his shoulder, the paper wrapping on the floor, the clock. Not the tickets, though, for at some point, though I did not see it happen, Edward had managed to conceal them. I had noticed before the way she watched, always observing, taking mental notes. It got on the nerves of some. Edward's other sister, Claire, had little time for Lucy. But there was something about her that reminded me of Lily Millington, the real Lily, an intelligence that made me fond. Edward, too, adored her, and was forever feeding her hungry mind with books.
"What do you say, Lucy?" he said now with a grin. "How do you fancy spending summer in the country? At a house on the river? Perhaps even a little boat?"
"At the house." Her face lit up even as she darted a look in my direction. I noted the invisible emphasis upon the words as if they were a secret. Edward laughed.
"The very same."
"But what if Mother..."
"Don't worry about Mother. I'll take care of everything."
And when Lucy smiled at him, a look of rapture came upon her face that changed her features completely. "I remember everything. Time no longer binds me. My experience of time is no longer bound. Past, present, and future are one. I can slow memories down. I can experience their events again in a flash. But the months of 1862 are different. They gather speed no matter what I do to stop them,
rolling like a coin let go at the top of a hill, picking up pace as they hurtle towards the end. When Edward told me about the night of the following, the trees of Hampstead wore only the merest of buds. The branches were all but bare, and the sky was low and grey. Yet, once the tale was told, the summer of Birchwood Manor was already upon us. Part 3. The Summer of Birchwood Manor. Chapter 24. Summer 1862. It was Lucy's first time on a train, and for the half hour since they'd left the station, she had sat very still, trying to decide whether or not she could feel the velocity impacting on her organs. Edward had laughed when she asked if he was worried, and Lucy had pretended she was joking. "Our organs are safe from the railways," he'd said, taking her hand and giving it a squeeze. "It's the well-being of the countryside we should be concerned about."
"Better not let Fanny hear you say that."
This was Claire, who had a habit of listening in. Edward frowned when she said it but didn't answer. Fanny's father's role in encouraging the spread of train lines across the surface of Britain did not sit well with Edward, who believed that nature should be valued for itself and not in terms of the resources it yielded to those inclined to exploitation. It was not an entirely easy opinion to hold, as Thurston enjoyed pointing out, for a man who intended to marry into railway money. Mother's friend John Ruskin went a step further, warning that the push of the railway lines into every hidden corner of the globe was a human folly.
"A fool always wants to shorten space and time,"
he had announced when he was leaving the house in Hampstead the other day.
"A wise man wants to lengthen both."
By and by, Lucy stopped thinking about her organs and the vandalism of the countryside, and found herself becoming distracted instead by the sheer marvel of it all. At one point, another train travelling in the same direction swept onto an adjoining line, and when she looked across and into the other carriage, it appeared stationary beside her. There was a man sitting adjacent, and their eyes met, and Lucy fell to thinking about time and motion and speed, and began to glimpse the possibility that they weren't actually moving at all, that it was the earth instead that had started to spin rapidly beneath them. Her knowledge of the fixed laws of physics suddenly loosened, and her mind exploded with possibilities. She was overcome with a fierce desire to share her ideas, but when she glanced across the carriage table to where Felix Bernard and his wife Adele were sitting, her excitement fizzled flat. Lucy knew Adele a little, because before she had married Felix, she had used to come to the house to model for Edward. She was in four of his paintings, and for a time had been one of his favourites. Lately, she had ambitions to be a photographer herself. Adele and Felix had argued about something at Paddington Station and were now at odds. Adele pretending engrossment in the English Woman's Journal, Felix properly engrossed by the inspection he was carrying out of his new camera. Across the aisle, Claire was making eyes at Thurston, a common enough state of affairs, ever since he'd asked her to model for his new painting. Everybody said that Thurston was very handsome, but he reminded Lucy, with his strutting gait and heavy thighs, of one of Grandfather's prize racehorses. He was not returning Claire's attentions, but was focused instead on Edward and his current model, Lily Millington. Lucy followed his gaze. She could understand why they drew his attention. There was something about the way they were together, as if unaware of everybody else in the carriage, that made Lucy want to watch them too. Finding no one available with whom to share her thoughts, Lucy kept them to herself. She decided it was probably for the best. She was eager to make a good impression on Edward's friends, and Claire said that such pronouncements about energy and matter and space and time made her sound as if she belonged in Bedlam. Edward, of course, said the opposite. He said that she had a good brain and that it was important she should use it. What hubris it was, he said, that mankind should think to halve the powers of the human race by ignoring the minds and words of the female half of it. Lucy had pleaded with Mother that she might have a governess, or better yet, be sent to school, but Mother had only looked at her concernedly, felt her forehead for fever, and told her that she was a strange little thing and would do well to put such foolish thoughts aside. Once she had even called Lucy in to see Mr. Ruskin, who was having tea in the parlour, and Lucy had been made to stand by the door as he instructed her gently that a woman's intellect was not for
invention or creation,
but for
sweet ordering, arrangement and decision.
Thank God for Edward, who kept her well supplied with books. Lucy was currently reading a new one, The Chemical History of a Candle, which contained six of the Christmas lectures for young people that Michael Faraday had given at the Royal Institution. It offered an interesting enough description of candle flames and combustion, carbon particles and the luminescent zone, and it was a gift from Edward, so Lucy was determined to appreciate every word. But, truth be told, it was a little basic. She'd had it on her lap since they left Paddington, but couldn't bring herself to open it now, letting her thoughts rest instead upon the summer ahead. 4 whole weeks at Birchwood Manor, with Edward as chaperone. Ever since Mother had said that, yes, she could go, Lucy had been counting down the days, crossing them off the calendar in her bedroom. She had it on good authority that other mothers might have minded their 13-year-old daughter spending the summer in company with a group of artists and their models, but Bettina Radcliffe was utterly unlike any of the other mothers that Lucy knew. She was a bohemian, according to their grandparents, and since Father died had become expert at attaching herself to the travel plans of others. She was spending July on a tour of the Amalfi Coast, ending in Naples where her friends, the Potters, had set up house. Far from worrying that Lucy might be morally corrupted, Mother had been exceedingly grateful to Edward when he suggested that his youngest sister should join him and his friends at Birchwood Manor for the summer, as it meant she would be spared having to endure the grudging largesse of the grandparents. "Which is one less thing to worry about," she'd said airily, before returning excitedly to her packing. There was another reason that Edward wanted Lucy there over the summer. She was the first person he had told when he bought the house. It was January 1861, and he had been away on one of his faraways for 3 weeks, 4 days, and 2 hours. Lucy had been reading On the Origin of Species, again, lying across the bed in her room with its dormer window overhanging the street in their house in Hampstead. Suddenly she heard her brother's familiar rhythm on the pavement below. Lucy knew everybody's footfall, the drag of the heavy man who brought the milk, the tick-tick cough of the frail phlegmy chimney sweep, Claire's trivial scuttle, and Mother's spindle-sharp heels. But her favourite sound was the purpose and promise of Edward's booted tread. Lucy hadn't needed to look through the window for confirmation. She tossed aside her book, flew down all 4 flights of stairs and across the hall, leaping into Edward's arms just as he crossed the threshold into the house. At 12, Lucy had been too old, really, for such behaviour, but she was small for her age, and Edward was easily able to catch her. Lucy adored Edward, and had done so since she was a tiny baby in her crib. She hated it when he went away, leaving her with none but Claire and Mother for company. He was only ever gone for a month or so at a time, but without him the days dragged, and the list of things that she'd been keeping in her head to tell him grew as long as her leg. As soon as she reached his arms, she started her report, each word tripping over the one before it in her rush to account for everything that had happened since he'd left. Usually, Edward listened avidly to her stories before presenting her with the latest treasure he had procured on her behalf, always a book, and always an indulgence of her love for science, history, and mathematics. This time, however, he had held his finger to her lips to silence her and said that her report must wait, for it was his turn to speak. He had done something incredible, he said, and he needed to share it with her at once. Lucy had been intrigued but equally gratified. Claire and Mother were in the house, yet it was she, Lucy, who had been chosen. Edward's attention was like a light being shone, and Lucy basked in its warmth. She went downstairs with him to the kitchen, the one place they could always be sure the others wouldn't bother them. And it was there, as they sat together at the cook's waxed and worn table, that Edward told her about the house he had bought. Twin gables, a country garden, the river and the copse of trees. The description was familiar, even before he said,
"It's the one, Lucy, the very one, from the night of the following."
Lucy had drawn breath then, stars of memory prickling her skin. She had known exactly which house he meant. The night of the following was legend between the two of them. Lucy had only been 5 years old when it happened, but the night was seared onto her memory. She would never forget how strange he was when he finally returned the next morning, his hair all tangled and his eyes wild. It had taken a full day before he would speak about it, but he had told her in the end, the two of them sitting inside the ancient wardrobe in the attic at Beechworth. Lucy was the only person Edward had ever confided in about the night of the following. He had trusted her with his greatest secret, and it had become an emblem of the bond between them.
"Are you going to live there?"
she said, her mind skipping immediately to the possibility that she might lose him to the countryside. He laughed and brushed his hand through his dark hair.
"I've no plans yet beyond possession. They will say it was a madness, Lucy, a madness, and they'll be right. But I know you understand. I had to have it. The house has been calling to me since the night I first saw it. Now, at last, I've answered."
Across the aisle, as Lily Millington laughed at something that Edward had said, Lucy regarded her brother's current model. She was beautiful. But Lucy suspected that she might not have realised quite how beautiful without Edward's guidance. That was his gift. Everybody said so. He was able to see things that others did not, and then, through his art, alter his spectators' perceptions so that they could not help but see as well. In the last of his Academy notes, Mr. Ruskin had called this the
Radcliffe sensory swindle.
As Lucy watched, Edward brushed a gleaming strand of Lily's red hair from her face. He tucked it behind her ear, and the model smiled. It was the sort of smile that hinted at previous conversations, and Lucy felt something unexpected and shivery rise up inside her. The first time that Lucy saw Lily Millington, she had been little more than a haze of fiery red in the glasshouse at the bottom of the garden. It had been May 1861, and Lucy, a bit short-sighted, had thought at first that she was looking at the leaves of a potted Japanese maple tree through the glass. Edward had a fondness for exotic plants and was forever visiting Mr. Romano on the corner of Willow Road, making sketches of the Italian man's daughters in exchange for samples of the newest plants brought back from the Americas or even the Antipodes. It was one of their many shared passions. For Lucy, too, delighted in these living, breathing visitors from faraway places, wondrous glimpses into parts of the globe quite unlike their own. It was only when Mother told Lucy to take two cups of tea down the path on a tray that she realised that Edward had a model in the studio. Her curiosity had been aroused immediately, for she knew who this must be. One could not live within the same house as Edward and fail to partake in the great peaks and troughs of his passions. Some months before, he had fallen into a slump from which it seemed he would not resurrect himself. He had been painting Adele, but had reached a point where he had exhausted the inspiration to be drawn from her small, neat features.
"It isn't that her face isn't pleasing," he'd explained to Lucy, pacing back and forth in the studio as she sat upon the rosewood chair by the furnace. "It's only that the space between her pretty ears is vacant."
Edward had a theory about beauty. He said that the turn of the nose, the cheekbones and lips, the colour of the eyes and the way that the hairs curled at the nape of the neck were all well and good, but that what made a person radiate, whether as oil on canvas or as an albumen print on paper, was intelligence.
"I don't mean the ability to explain the workings of the internal combustion engine or to conduct a lesson on how the telegraph sends a message from here to there. I mean that some people have a light inside them, a facility for inquiry and interest and engagement that cannot be fabricated and cannot be counterfeited by the artist, no matter his or her skill.
One morning, though, Edward had arrived home with the dawn, an agitation in his step. The house had barely roused when he threw open the door, but as always, the house itself registered his arrival. The stillness of the entrance hall, ever sensitive to his presence, began to reverberate as he tossed his coat onto the hook, and when Lucy, Claire and Mother appeared in their nightdresses at the top of the stairs, he held his arms out and declared, with a joyous smile spread wide across his face, that he had found her, the one that he'd been looking for. There was much relief all round as they gathered at the breakfast table to hear his story. The fates, he began, in their infinite wisdom, had put her in his path at Drury Lane. He had spent the evening at the theatre with Thurston Holmes, and it was there, in the crowded, smoky foyer, that he had first caught sight of her. Lucy would later glean, during a wine-infused dispute between Edward and Thurston, on another matter entirely, that it was Thurston who had noticed the fine-limbed, red-haired beauty. He who had observed the way the light caught her hair and rendered her skin alabaster, who had realised that she looked exactly like the subject of the painting that Edward had been planning. It was Thurston, too, who had pulled Edward's shirt sleeve, swinging him around, thereby breaking off the conversation he'd been having with a fellow to whom he owed some money, in order that his own eyes might lock upon the woman in the deep blue dress. Edward had been spellbound. In that instant, he said he saw his painting complete. While Edward was experiencing this revelation, however, the woman had turned to leave. Without a thought as to what he was doing, he began pushing through the crowd, powered by a spirit quite outside himself. He knew only that he had to reach her. He threaded his way through the busy foyer after the woman, slipping through the side exit and into the street. And thank goodness he had, Edward said, glancing around the breakfast table, for when he finally caught up with her in the laneway, he was just in time to rescue her. At the precise moment that Edward was wending his way through the crowds inside the foyer, a man dressed all in black, a man of most deplorable character, had noticed her alone in the alleyway and hurtled past, ripping an heirloom bracelet from her wrist. Claire and Mother gasped, and Lucy said, "Did you see him?" "I was too late. Her brother had already set off after the fellow, but did not catch him. He returned just as I came upon her in the alley. He thought at first glance that I was the perpetrator, returned to finish the job, and called, 'Stop, thief!' But she explained quickly that I was no thief, and his demeanour changed at once." The woman had turned then, Edward said, and moonlight illuminated the features of her face, and he saw that he had been right when he had glimpsed her from afar. She was indeed the one that he'd been waiting for.
"What did you do next?" Lucy asked, as the parlourmaid brought a fresh pot of breakfast tea.
"I'm afraid that I have no talent for polite intimations," he said. "I simply told her that I had to paint her."
Claire raised her eyebrows.
"And what did she say to that?"
"More importantly," said Mother, "what did her brother say?"
"He was caught by complete surprise. He asked what I meant, and I explained as best I could. I fear I wasn't as erudite as I might have been. I was still somewhat dazzled."
"Did you tell him that you had exhibited at the Royal Academy?" said Mother. "Did you tell him that you had Mr. Ruskin's favour, that your grandfather is titled?"
Edward said he had done all of that and more. He said that he may even have exaggerated their position a little, naming all of the ancient land and titles he had heretofore done his best to ignore. He had even offered to have his own mother, Lady Radcliffe, come to call on their parents to reassure them that their daughter would be in good hands.
"I felt it was important, Mother, for the brother made a point of saying that they would need to speak with their parents before any commitment was made. That a respectable woman's reputation could be damaged by her employment as a painter's model."
The meeting had been agreed and the parties had said goodnight. Edward had walked along the river afterwards, and then through the dark London streets, sketching the woman's face in his mind. He was so enamoured with her that he had managed to misplace his wallet as he wandered, and had been forced to walk all the way back to Hampstead. When Edward's spirits were elated, no one could avoid being swept into his orbit, and while he related this tale, Lucy, Claire and Mother had listened avidly. As he reached the end, Mother needed to hear no more. She said that of course she would visit Mr. and Mrs. Millington and vouch for Edward. Her lady's maid was set immediately to repairing the moth holes in her finest dress, and a carriage hired to take her down into London. A metallic scream, a fog of smoke, and the train began to slow. Lucy put her face up to the open window and saw that they were drawing into a station. The sign read, Swindon, which she knew was where they were disembarking. The platform was patrolled by a punctilious-looking man with a smart uniform and a shiny whistle that he was not timid in using. A number of porters were milling, waiting for arriving passengers. They alighted from the train, Edward and the other men going straight to the luggage compartments to see about the suitcases and art supplies, all of which, except Lucy's, she refused to be separated from her books, were loaded into a horse-drawn coach and sent on to the village of Birchwood. Lucy had assumed that they would all go by coach too, but Edward said that the day was too perfect to waste. Besides, the house was far better approached from the river than the road. And he was right. It was a glorious day. The sky was lustrous blue, with a clarity that was rarely seen in London, and the air was tinged with country smells like seeding grasses and the tang of sun-warmed manure. Edward led the way, and he did not stick to the roads, taking them instead through wildflower meadows spotted with yellow kingcups, pink foxgloves, and blue forget-me-nots. Delicate white sprays of cow parsley were everywhere, and at times they came upon a meandering stream and had to look for stepping stones in order to cross. It was a long walk, but they did not rush. The 4 hours passed in a flow, broken up by lunch and a paddle in the shallows near Lechlade and a few spots of sketching. The atmosphere was one of frivolity and laughter. Felix had a cloth-wrapped bundle of strawberries which he took from his bag to share. Adele wove wreaths of flowers for all of the women, even Lucy, to wear like crowns. And Thurston disappeared at one stage, only to be found with his hat on his face, fast asleep on the soft green grass beneath a great weeping willow. As the day reached the peak of its heat, Lily Millington, whose long hair fell loose down her back, wrapped it into a shimmering knot and fastened it on the top of her head with Edward's silk scarf. The skin revealed at the nape of her neck was smooth and white as a lily, and made Lucy look away. Near the Halfpenny Bridge, they took the steps down to the water's edge and followed the river east, through the cattle-filled meadow and beyond St. John's Lock. By the time they reached the rim of the woods, the sun, though still providing light, had surrendered its heat. Edward was always talking about light, and Lucy knew he would say that it had lost its yellow. The effect was one that Lucy liked. Without the sheen of yellow, the rest of the world seemed blue. The house, Edward told them, lay on the other side of the woods. He insisted that this was the best way to approach it for the first time, for only when one arrived from the river could the building's true proportions be glimpsed. The explanation was reasonable, and the others didn't question it, but Lucy knew there was more to his thinking than he'd admitted. Inside the woods was the clearing from the night of the following. Edward was leading them along the very path he'd taken that night, when he fled through the trees and fields, beneath the watchful silver stars, and finally spotted the light in the attic calling to him. Within the woods, everyone walked in silent single file. Lucy was aware of the sounds of twigs cracking underfoot and leaves rustling, and odd noises at times in the profuse greenery along the secluded track. The branches of the trees in this pocket were not straight. They grew towards the canopy in wavy ribbons, and their trunks were covered in ferns and lichens. They were oaks, she thought, with hazel and birch among them. The light fell spangled in places, and the air seemed alive with anticipation. When they finally reached the clearing, Lucy could almost hear the leaves breathing. It wasn't difficult to imagine how frightening this place might become in the dead of night. Lucy would never forget how Edward had looked all those years ago when he finally made it back to their grandparents' house after the night of the following. She glanced ahead, curious to see how he was reacting to being back here now, and was surprised when she saw him reach out to take Lily Millington's hand. They all continued across the clearing and then wended their way through the woods on the other side. Finally, the air began to lighten, and with a last scramble up the overgrown bank, they emerged into the open. A wildflower meadow spilled out before them, and beyond it sat a house with twin gables and a splendid display of chimneys. Edward turned around, a look of joyous triumph on his face, and Lucy found herself smiling too. The strange enchantment of the woods had lifted, and the others now began to talk excitedly, as if, having seen the house, the thrilling promise of the summer ahead could finally be tasted. Was it true that there was a rowing boat? They asked. Yes, Edward said. It was inside the field barn over there. He'd had a jetty built especially down at the river. How much of the land was his? All of it, he said, as far as the eye could see. Were there bedrooms overlooking the river? Many of the whole first story was room upon room, and the attic above held more besides. With a loud call to arms, Thurston began to run, and Felix fell in quickly beside him, racing. Claire and Adele linked arms as they started across the meadow. Edward caught Lucy's gaze and winked at her. "Hurry, little sister," he said. "Go and claim the best room for yourself." Lucy grinned and nodded and started bounding after the others. She felt free, more alive than usual, aware of the country air on her face and the lingering warmth of the afternoon sun. The joy of sharing this most important moment with Edward. In such spirit as she reached the other side of the meadow, she turned back to beckon him. But he wasn't watching after her. He and Lily Millington were walking slowly towards the house, their heads bent close together in deep conversation. Lucy waited to catch his eye. She waved her arm to attract his attention, but all to no avail. At length, she turned around and continued, disappointed, towards the house. And for the first time since they'd set off from Paddington Station early that morning, it occurred to Lucy to wonder where Edward's fiancée, Fanny Brown, was. Chapter 25. Birchwood Manor was one of those places in which the threads of time slackened and came unstrung. Lucy noticed how quickly the others all slipped into a routine, as if they had been at the house forever, and she wondered whether it was a function of the weather. The stretch of summer days that seemed to go on and on, the particular collection of people that Edward had gathered, or maybe even something intrinsic to the house itself. She knew what Edward would say to that. Ever since he'd learned the tale of the Eldritch children as a boy, he had been convinced that the land within this bend of the river held special properties. Lucy prided herself on being of a rational persuasion, but she had to admit that there was something unusual about the house. Edward had written ahead to engage a young woman from the village, Emma Stearns, as a maid of all work, to come in early each morning and then to leave after the evening meal had been prepared. On the first night, when they arrived from the railway, traipsing across the wildflower meadow towards the house, Emma had been waiting for them. She had followed Edward's instructions to the letter, and the large iron table in the garden had been covered with a white linen cloth, a tremendous spread laid out upon it. Glass lanterns had been suspended from the lowest branches of the chestnut tree, and as dusk fell, the wicks were lit and the candles began to flicker. Their illumination strengthened with the darkening night, and as the wine flowed, Felix took out his guitar. Adele started to dance while a chorus of robins sang away the last of the day's light, and eventually Edward stood up on the table to recite Keats' Bright Star. The house slept like the dead that night, and everyone woke late the next morning in high spirits. They had all been too tired the evening before to investigate properly, and now ran from room to room exclaiming over this view or that detail. The house had been built by a master craftsman, Edward said proudly, looking on delighted as his friends explored. Every feature had been knowingly included. In Edward's view, such attention to detail made the house truthful, and he loved everything about it. Every piece of furniture, every curtain, every whirl in every floorboard, hewn from the nearby woods. His favourite aspect was an engraving above the door in a room with mulberry fruit and leaf wallpaper. The room was on the ground floor with large windows set into the back wall that made it seem almost part of the garden it overlooked. The engraving read, "Truth, Beauty, Light,"
and Edward could not stop staring at it in wonder and saying, "You see, this house was meant for me." Over the coming days, Edward sketched the house relentlessly. He went everywhere with his new leather satchel across his shoulder and could often be seen sitting amongst the long grasses of the meadow, hat upon his head, staring up at the house with an expression of deep contentment, before returning his attention to his work. Lily Millington, Lucy noted, was always by his side. Lucy had asked Edward about Fanny's whereabouts. He had taken her on the first morning, leading her along the halls by hand to show her the Birchwood Manor Library.
"I thought of you especially when I saw these shelves," he told her. "Look at this collection, Lucy. Books on every subject you could care to mention. It is up to you now to fill your mind with all of the knowledge that the world and its brightest scholars have acquired and published. There will come a time, I know, when women will have the same opportunities afforded men. How can it not come to pass when women are the smarter and more numerous? Until then, you must take control of your own destiny. Read, remember, think."
Edward did not make such declarations insincerely, and Lucy promised that she would do as he said.
"You can trust me," she replied solemnly. "I will read every book on every shelf before the summer is over."
He laughed when she said it.
"Well, perhaps there's no need to work quite so quickly as that. There'll be other summers. Make sure you leave enough time to enjoy the river and the gardens."
"Of course."
And then, because the conversation had reached a natural lull,
"Are we expecting Fanny to join us?"
Edward's demeanour did not change, but he said, "No, Fanny isn't coming." And then he moved at once to point out a nook beside the fireplace that he suggested would be perfect for concealed reading.
"No one would ever know that you were in there, and I have it, on good authority, that reading when hidden improves the experience immeasurably."
Lucy had let the subject of Fanny drop. Later she would wish that she had probed further, asked a few more questions, but in truth she did not much care for Fanny and was glad that she wouldn't be joining them. At the time, Edward's perfunctory, almost dismissive response had said it all. Fanny was a bore. She commandeered Edward's attention and tried to make him someone he was not. As a fiancée, she was far more threatening to Lucy than a model. Models came and went, but marriage was forever. Marriage meant a new house for Edward somewhere else. Lucy couldn't imagine living without her brother, and she couldn't imagine what it would be like for him to have to live with Fanny. Lucy had no plans for marriage, not unless the perfect person happened along. Her ideal husband, she had decided, would be someone just like herself, or Edward, and they would be very happy, the two of them, alone together forever. Edward had been right about the library. It was as if it had been designed and stocked with Lucy in mind. Shelves lined the walls, and unlike the collection at their grandparents' house, which comprised copious religious tracts and pamphlets protecting against the commission of social solecisms, here were real books. The previous owners of Birchwood Manor had amassed a tremendous amount of material on all manner of fascinating subjects, and where there were gaps, Edward had sent to London for further titles. Lucy spent every spare moment scaling the sliding ladder, scanning the spines and planning the summer weeks that stretched ahead, and she had many spare moments to fill, because from the first day that they arrived, she was left to her own devices. Even as they had carried out their initial explorations of the house, each artist had been focused on finding the perfect place in which to work. There was an added urgency to their quest, for just before they left for Birchwood, Mr. Ruskin had undertaken to support an exhibition of their collective works in the autumn. Each member of the Magenta Brotherhood had a new creation in mind, and the air was thus infused with a blend of creativity, competition, and possibility. Once the rooms had been chosen, each painter fell at once to unpacking the art supplies that had come by coach from the railway station.
Thurston chose the large sitting room at the front of the house because he said that the south-facing window afforded him the perfect light. Lucy tried to stay out of his way, partly because she found Thurston inexplicably disconcerting, and partly because she was embarrassed to have to see her sister's big mooning eyes. Lucy had chanced upon Claire modelling when the door was open and had needed to run through the meadow at full speed afterwards just to rid herself of the uncomfortable, creeping sensation. Lucy had glimpsed the painting before she left. It was fine, of course, even if still in its earliest incarnation, for Thurston was a competent technician. But something had struck her as notable. The woman in the painting, though she shared the languid position that Claire was modelling, draped with ennui over the chaise longue, had been given lips that belonged unmistakably to Lily Millington. Felix had commandeered the small enclosure of the panelled drawing room on the ground floor, and when Edward pointed out that it had hardly any light at all, he had agreed eagerly and said that this was the point. Felix, who had heretofore been known for painting moody scenes from myth and legend, now declared an intention to use photography rather than paint to portray the same subjects. "I am going to make an image of Tennyson's Lady of Shalott to rival Mr. Robinson's. Your river is perfect. It even has the willows and aspens on offer. It shall be Camelot, you'll see." Fierce debate had been raging ever since amongst the group as to whether it was possible to render the same artistic effect in the new medium. At dinner one night, Thurston said that photographs were a gimmick.
"A cheap trick. All well and good for creating reminders of loved ones, but not for communicating on a serious subject."
At which point Felix had taken a button from his pocket, a small tin badge, and flipped it over in his fingers.
"Tell that to Abraham Lincoln," he said. "Tens of thousands of these have been given away. There are people all over the continent of America wearing the man's face, his very image, on their clothing. Once we wouldn't have known what Lincoln looked like, let alone what he thought. Now he has 40% of the vote."
"Why didn't his opponents do the same thing?" asked Adele.
"They tried, but it was too late. He who acts first wins. But I'll promise you this. We won't see another election in which the candidates don't trade on their image."
Thurston took the tin badge and flipped it like a coin.
"I'm not denying that it's a useful political tool," he said, slapping the badge down on the top of one hand. "But you can't tell me that this is art."
He lifted his palm to reveal Lincoln's face.
"Not that particular button, no, but think of Roger Fenton's work."
"The Crimean pictures are extraordinary," Edward agreed. "And certainly the communication of a serious subject."
"But not art."
Thurston poured the last of the red wine into his glass.
"I will allow that photographs are useful tools for reporting news and happenings, for performing as the
eye of history," Lily Millington proffered.
"Yes, thank you, Lily. The eye of history. But art, they are not."
Lucy, sitting quietly at the end of the table, enjoying a second serving of pudding, loved the idea of the photograph as the eye of history. So often in her own reading about the past, and in the digging she had been doing in the woods behind the house, where she had started turning up odd and ancient remnants, she was frustrated by the need to extrapolate and imagine. What a gift it was to future generations that photographs could now record the truth. Lucy had read an article in the London Review that referred to the unimpeachable evidence of the photograph and said that from now on, nothing would happen without photography being used to create a tangible, transferable memory of the occurrence. Lucy looked up so sharply that a dollop of cream fell from her spoon. It was Lily Millington who had taken the words right out of Lucy's mouth. That is, she had taken the London Review's words right out of Lucy's mind.
"Just so, Lily," Felix was saying. "One day the photographic image will be ubiquitous. Cameras will be so small and compact that people will carry them on straps around their necks."
Thurston rolled his eyes.
"And their necks will be stronger too, I suppose. These Amazonian people of the future. Felix, you're making my point with your talk of ubiquity. Having a camera to point does not an artist make. An artist is a man who sees beauty in a sulfuric fog where others see only pollution.
Or a woman, said Lily Millington.
Why would anybody see a woman in pollution?
Thurston stopped as he realised what she meant.
Oh, I see. Yes, very good, Lily. Very good. Or a lady who sees beauty.
Claire chimed in then with a self-evident observation that there was no colour in a photograph, and Felix explained that this simply meant he would have to use light and shadow, framing and composition, to evoke the same emotions. But Lucy was only half listening now. She couldn't stop looking at Lily Millington. She did not think she had ever heard the other models say anything sensible, let alone show up Thurston Holmes. Lucy had imagined, if she had given it any thought at all, that Edward would exhaust the inspiration he had drawn from Lily Millington, just as he had grown tired of the other models who came before her. But she glimpsed now that Lily Millington was different from the others after all, that she was a different kind of model entirely. Lily Millington and Edward spent each day squirreled away in the Mulberry Room, where Edward had set up his easel. He was working diligently. Lucy recognised the look of distracted inspiration that came upon his features when he was in the process of creating a painting. But so far he had been unusually circumspect about his planned piece. Lucy had thought at first that this must be an effect of his contretemps with Mr. Ruskin after the latter's lack of support the previous year when Edward exhibited the La Belle painting. Between Ruskin's appraisal of the work and Mr. Charles Dickens' reporting of it, Edward had been left fuming. When the review was printed, he had stormed down to his studio in the back garden and set fire to every work penned by Mr. Dickens, along with his prized copy of Mr. Ruskin's Modern Painters. Lucy, who had lined up at W.H. Smith & Son every week between December 1860 and August 1861 in order to purchase the latest instalment of Great Expectations, had to hide her treasured copies of All the Year Round, lest they too should be sacrificed to his fury. Now, though, she had begun to wonder if there was something else at play. It was hard to say what it was exactly, but there was an element of secrecy that surrounded Edward and Lily Millington when they were together. And just the other day, Lucy had approached her brother when he was working in his sketchbook, and as soon as he realised that she was beside him, he'd snapped it shut. Not before she'd caught a glimpse, though, of a detailed study of Lily Millington's face. Edward did not like to be watched when he worked, but it was highly unusual for him to behave with quite so much furtiveness. It seemed particularly unwarranted in this case, because what was there to hide in a study of his model's features? The sketch had been like any of the 100 others that Lucy had already seen on his studio wall. Except for the pendant necklace she was wearing. Other than that, it was just the same. Whatever the case, Edward was much intent upon his work. And so, while the others were busy during the day, and Emma was occupied by her many tasks, Lucy took possession of the library. She had told Edward that she would pace herself, but she had no intention of doing any such thing. Each day she chose a clutch of books, and then took them outside with her to read. Sometimes she read in the barn, other times beneath the ferns in the garden, and on days when there was too much breeze for Felix to attempt to shoot the Lady of Shalott, when he had stalked about the Dawn meadow with a finger lifted to assess the prevailing wind, and then returned to the house with his hands thrust deep and disconsolately in his pockets, she would sit in the little rowing boat, moored down at Edward's new jetty. They had been at Birchwood for almost 2 weeks when she came across a particularly ancient and dusty book, its covers hanging by threads. It had been pushed to the back of the very top library shelf, hidden from view. Lucy paused on the ladder and opened to the book's title page, where it was announced in elaborate font that the book was called Demonology, in form of a dialogue, divided into 3 books, and that it had been printed in Edinburgh by Robert Waldegrave, printer to the King's Majesty, in the year 1597. A book on necromancy and ancient black magic, written by the king, who had also brought them the plain English Bible, was of more than passing interest to Lucy.
and she put it under her arm and climbed down the ladder. She took a number of books with her that day when she set off for the river, along with her lunch, wrapped in cloth. The morning was hot and as clear as glass, and the air smelled like drying wheat and secret muddy underground things. Lucy climbed into the boat and rowed herself upstream. Although it wasn't still enough for Felix to make his photographic exposure, it was not windy, and Lucy planned to let the boat drift slowly back towards Edward's jetty. She stopped rowing as she neared St. John's Lock and took up On Liberty. It wasn't until after 1 o'clock that she finished with John Stuart Mill and opened Demonology. And she did not get far with King James's explanation.